So our first case this morning is United States v. Copeland, number 17-5125. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, this is a Johnson case involving a prior convictions qualification under the ACCA, the prior conviction being burglary in the state of California under Section 459, which, as we'll, I'm sure, discuss, has been commented on by the U.S. Supreme Court. So in this Northern District of Oklahoma case, the question is whether or not there is a initial showing of error or a jurisdictional showing, I think we understand now after Snyder and all those cases, where the court has jurisdiction by virtue of a defendant showing that there is a preponderance of evidence to support a conclusion that the residual clause is had been used in the previous sentencing. So understanding the Snyder analysis, which I think applies here, I think the first thing that we're looking at is the question is whether we have a silent record. And Snyder and subsequent cases that construe it, like Driscoll, I think Washington also refined that a bit more to punctuate that the court is looking for whether there is mention of the residual clause or another clause that justifies the ACCA sentence. We do have a silent record here. I don't think anyone, whether opposing counsel or district court, ever pointed to any place in the record, being the transcripts, the filed documents, or the pre-sentence investigation report. There is no reference to any ACCA clause. And so as I understand the quest for whether there is silence or mention, I think the answer is we have a silent record.
Well, is it totally silent on this issue? Didn't the sentencing judge make some reference to why the sentence was being enhanced?
The sentencing judge, as she says in her order that's under review, finds...
Well, no, I'm talking about the sentencing record in 2008, because the order under review is the 2017 order, but that references back to the sentencing itself, and the sentencing record we're looking at, as I understand it, is the sentencing record in 2008. So my question is that record silent as to why an ACCA enhancement was imposed?
That record is silent. In the record under review, Judge
Well, let
Egan,
me let me follow
okay.
up.
Okay.
Because it seems to me that when the court talked about, at the sentencing, the need, for example, we won't know about the ACCA predicate offense until the probation officer and your attorney get all the records from California, that doesn't seem silent to me. That seems like a clue as to where the district court was going. So could you address that?
Yes, this is the change of plea hearing that we're discussing, and the court says that we will round up, that players will round up these records. The probation office and defense counsel presumably will round up these records. It's a projection, as I understand it, because she's just orienting the defendant about how it probably is going to go. I would say, for one thing, there is never any mention of those records, no confirmation that that ever happened. And so, understood as orienting the defendant, it does not rise to the level of showing that we have a clear record. Secondly,
no,
it
may not be a clear record. I asked you whether it was silent. And so, I guess my question is, does that comment move the needle one way or the other as to whether the district court relied upon the enumerated clause to sentence or the residual clause?
I don't think it moves the needle because the silent record, as discussed in Driscoll and Washington, show that the court on review is looking for mention of a particular ACCA clause. And so we're lowering the bar down to something below that, which I don't know if that's compliant with these precedents, but I don't think that it moves the needle any at all.
Do you agree that the district court doesn't have to use the very words enumerated offense clause?
Oh, sure. No one would have to say those words.
Right. And then when we look at the change of plea transcript, what I'm most interested in is, of course, the district court starts off thinking that the guidelines are going to determine this armed career criminal question. And the probation officer corrects the district court and points out that guidelines require residential burglaries, but the ACCA does not. That would have nothing to do with the residual clause, and they're identical for 4B1.2 and 924E. The only reason to speak about the distinction between residential and other structures would be enumerated offense and generic burglary, would it not?
I don't know if that would be the only explanation for it, but I would grant, in my view, that in context, it would seem that that is what the reference is to. But the references that the district court made in the colloquy with the defendant during the change of plea hearing were to the application of the Armed Career Criminal Act, and that encompasses more than one option. It encompasses the enumerated clause, and it encompasses the residual clause. All of that is on the table. And so there is, the question that Snyder says we're looking to answer is, what was used at sentencing? So some months later, when the PSR is in hand and sentencing occurs, that is where the focus is.
Well, the district court here says, I relied on the enumerated offense clause. And when I go back, the district court, go back and read this transcript, I see that I relied on the enumerated offense clause because I'm discussing generic burglary. Why should we not take the district court at its word? Can we really overrule that?
She is making a finding based on a record which this court is reviewing. And this is de novo review. And I think also if it is looked at in light of what Driscoll provides to us as guidance, Driscoll cautions 892 F3rd 1133 footnote 4. This is in my brief, page 8, my reply brief, page 8. So this is briefed. And they caution that there should not be a jump to assumption that burglary, because it's in the enumerated clause, was the vehicle for ACCA's application in a prior sentencing.
But Driscoll doesn't involve a fact like this one, where there is discussion about residential versus commercial structures. So is it really that strong of an authority when we narrow in, as the district court did, on that language?
I'm not able to see how a discussion about a distinction between the ACCA and the career offender provisions tells us what was used at the time of sentencing.
Well, the discussion is on a point that would be irrelevant to the residual clause, but it would be highly relevant to the enumerated offense clause. That's why.
But as the court itself had pointed out, we could not draw any conclusion until we get the Shepherd documents, if you will, in hand. And so it's a cart before the horse thing. Before those documents are in hand, very clearly the district court was not pre-concluding at the change of plea hearing that the enumerated burglary is going to be the one. And I think Driscoll is vital where it says at the time of sentencing, it had long been established that burglary convictions do not inherently fall within the ACCA's enumerated offense of burglary, citing Taylor, which was 1990 law.
Counsel, You said a minute ago, de novo review. But Driscoll says, and I'm quoting, when we review a district court's finding that a sentencing court did not apply the residual clause to enhance a defendant's sentence, we review the factual determinations about the sentencing record, about the sentencing record for clear error. How do you reconcile that with your previous statement about de novo review?
My reply brief gets into the...
Well, no, I'd just like to hear the answer, not a reference to your reply
brief. I don't... Different cases say different things.
Well, Driscoll says this, and it's a recent case in this line of cases.
Then clear error, I would say clear error may apply. I don't know if I'm clear that clear error applies, but there's... A lot of confusion. I think that maybe it's not just mine. Maybe some case law may foment some confusion about where clear error ends and de novo begins. For instance, the question, Snyder says, the question of what clause was used is a factual question, but...
Isn't that the ultimate question here, is whether... Yeah. Whether Mr. Copeland showed by a preponderance that the residual clause was used.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And Judge Phillips has pointed out that there's at least some byplay in the record that points away from the residual clause. So how did Mr. Copeland show by a preponderance that the residual clause was used?
Because as we have in... Taylor from 1990 with a reference to California's Section 459 burglary, Taylor says that it is overbroad.
Well, okay.
And so, it's impossible.
So let's go back to the applicable cases. We've got Snyder and Driscoll, and they lay out this two-step process. One is looking at the sentencing record. One is looking at the relevant legal background. You seem to have now flipped over to the second step when you started talking about Taylor and overbreadth. Am I right so far? Is that where you are?
No.
Okay, where are we then?
In order to determine which clause was used, then there has to be some confirmation. And what I'm saying is that at the time of sentencing, you know, I think we're still addressing whether there's any background law that is available. If the court is saying that we're not there yet, we're not looking at background law. I think we have a silent record, and so maybe I have jumped to a step the court doesn't want me to jump to by addressing any background law at the time.
Well, on the background law, Des Camps, of course, comes years after this sentencing, the Des Camps case.
Yes.
And so up until that point, there had been a circuit split whether a district court could do just as the district court did here. So we look at the law at the time of the sentencing, and the district court was not precluded from doing that. How do you avoid that being dispositive?
I think the district split issue is over what issue?
The Des Camps issue and whether or not California generic burglary matches the federal generic definition because of lack of unlawful entry. I thought that's where you were headed with that.
Okay, well, Des Camps says, I was beginning to say that Des Camps said, look at Taylor. Taylor cited 459 California burglary and said it's overbroad. And so we knew that in 1990, and this is California burglary that is at issue. So anybody looking at it with this record that doesn't clearly say what was used would have to conclude that I've got a problem with this because it's clearly overbroad.
Does it matter that he conceded the point that it did apply?
I don't know of any record reference that there's concession that it did apply. Well, I know there was no objection.
At sentencing, they ask any objection to the PSR, and the PSR had found the ACCA, and there was no objection and no direct appeal.
That's exactly.
So
yes.
Does that matter?
I don't think that it's a waiver or an invited error type of situation. I mean, I think there's neglect all around not to really just A-B compare the elements of the two statutes, really, and I think that's at the heart of this. Thank you.
Counsel, you're out of time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Lena Alam and I represent the United States. I'd like to begin by clarifying the standard of review debate that Mr. Derryberry and I have been having. The ultimate question in the case is whether the defendant has proven by a preponderance of the evidence that his motion relied on a new rule of constitutional law made retroactive by the Supreme Court. And that question whether the district court properly denied the defendant's motion is subject to de novo review. What is subject to clear error review are the district court's factual findings. And those factual findings include the district court's explicit factual finding that the record in this case was not silent.
Isn't there another way, though, of characterizing the dispositive issue? And that is whether Mr. Copeland has shown by a preponderance that the district court relied on the residual clause at sentencing.
Yes.
Isn't that a question we need to answer?
Yeah, and effectively, that is the question.
Okay, but if that is the question, why isn't that a factual question? I mean, either the court relied on it or it didn't.
And I think the confusion arises from Washington, which says the district court's denial of a successive motion under these circumstances, or dismissal of a successive motion under these circumstances, is subject to de novo review. But there is, I think the reason that standard applies is in a case where the court must look at the relevant legal background, that's a legal determination that would be subject to de novo review.
Well, I'm with you on that part. But once you look at the legal background, mm-hmm. isn't that done for the purpose of aiding in making the determination whether the sentencing court relied on the residual clause or not? I mean, of course, if you're trying to determine what the law was in 2008, we would do that de novo, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay. But under Snyder and Driscoll, the reason we do that is to help us decide what the district court actually did. And that, why isn't that a factual question?
I think if you look at Snyder and Driscoll, and a little bit at Washington as well, when it's creating sort of fiction, when the record is silent and we look to the relevant legal background, what the court is doing is not finding what the district court actually did, but really what it must have done given the relevant legal background. That's a legal finding rather than a factual finding. Whereas the issue here, where the sentencing record is not silent, is a factual question as to what the district court actually did, not what it must have done based on the law at the time. Does that make sense? It's my best attempt to integrate those two standards of review and to explain why the cases.
What does the sentencing record show then that the court actually did? I mean, the district judge in 2017 seems to think that she knew what she did and it wasn't the residual clause.
Right. And that's our first point, is that Judge Egan is very certain that when she sentenced Mr. Copeland in 2008, that there was no possibility that she relied on the residual
clause. But do we go with what she thought she did in 2017, or do we do what Snyder and Driscoll say that we need to do and go back and look at the record? Because in 2017, she said, oh, well, it was a generic burglary. She never used those words in 2008.
That's absolutely correct. What we do is we review for clear error her 2017 conclusion that she didn't rely on the residual clause. And to review that for clear error, we look to the 2008 record. And first we look to the record before the district court. And if that is silent, then we look to the relevant legal background. Looking to the record before the district court, I believe the court has identified the major points that I'd like to make. First, that the district court tries to explain to Mr. Copeland that the question that the lawyers are all talking to the court about is whether his first prior conviction, whether that California burglary is going to qualify. And she says, as a, I think she says crime of violence, she may say violent felony under the ACCA. But then on the page, on page 16 of volume 2 of the record of the transcript, she asks a clarifying question to the United States probation officer, and the probation officer, Larry Morris, explains that there are two different definitions, that the definition of crime of violence under the guidelines is different from the one in the statute. And in the guidelines, it in the definition limits burglaries to residential, but in the statute, it doesn't limit
it. It's just a volunteered statement by the probation officer. The district court wasn't was not inquiring about that. The probation officer just gave that information. But when the district court is discussing the need to collect the documents and so forth, that doesn't point one way or the other. You could collect the documents for the residual clause just as easily.
Absolutely.
And when Judge Matheson says that, although the district court says she advised that we were looking at generic burglary, that's not in the record. This particular defendant, I believe, would be out of prison right now if he had been sentenced today and received the same amount of time. Do we really put a decade or more on this person based on this kind of loose language and fuzzy recall?
We need not rely merely on the record before the district court or the district court's own conclusion that she didn't sentence him based on the residual clause. The courts discussed the Descamps case from 2013. Perhaps the most significant part of that, from my perspective, is that in 2013, the Supreme Court reversed a Ninth Circuit case, a 2012 Ninth Circuit case, finding that the modified categorical approach could be used to consider California burglary under Cal Penal Code Section 459 as a generic burglary, even though the statute itself omits the element of unlawful entry. Even more interesting than the fact that the Ninth Circuit had so held was that the original Descamps district court case that the Ninth Circuit was affirming was a 2008 sentencing. I think it was January 12, 2008. Matthew Descamps was sentenced by the Western District of Washington using the modified categorical approach, applying that to 459, despite the fact that he was convicted of an offense that didn't have as an element unlawful burglary. All of this because until Descamps, the understanding of element and when a modified categorical approach could be used was not clear. And so in 2008, in this case as well, which took place after that sentencing in the Western District of Washington, it was absolutely plausible that the district court would have first applied the enumerated offense of burglary.
It's entirely possible, but we don't know. The district court didn't say, up until Descamps, I thought I could do this, so here I did it, and that proves that it's an enumerated offense. It's just a gloss over this to look at this, what seems to me uncertain and ambiguous change of plea transcript, and then a conclusion. I conclude that I relied on the enumerated offense clause because I said it was generic burglary, which he didn't. And remember, Driscoll, the district court judge, Judge Johnson there, had said, I sentenced on the enumerated offense clause, and we reversed that. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we do the same thing here?
Because in Washington, and in a successive 2255 as here, this court has made very clear that the burden falls on the defendant. Unless the defendant himself can show that that more likely than not he was sentenced under the residual clause, this court must affirm the district court's finding. And to the extent that we are under the clear error standard on the district court's findings of fact, in order to overturn Judge Egan's findings of fact, you must find that her findings were wholly unsupported by the record in this case.
Well, let's go back to something you said earlier when we were talking about standards of review. If the relevant legal background shows that the sentencing must have been based on the residual clause. Wouldn't that be enough to grant relief here?
If the record were silent or ambiguous, yes, it would.
All right. And you said, well, maybe before DeCamp, you could argue that the modified categorical, and I mean, there's play in the joints as to whether it could be applied in 2008. But the problem is, there is nothing in the record to show that it was. She mentioned the background documents, but there's no indication that the Shepherd documents were ever obtained. And so we're operating on a record that wouldn't have permitted the modified categorical approach.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The record that shows that the documents were obtained is the fact that the parties engaged in this long discussion at the change of plea, and then at the time the pre-sentence report was prepared, the pre-sentence report contains findings that describe conduct that would have, under the modified categorical approach, qualified.
There is nothing. There are no Shepherd documents in the record.
Absolutely not. And Washington says...
Wait, are you agreeing with me or are you not agreeing with me?
I am agreeing with you that
all right,
there are
no Shepherd documents. If there are no Shepherd documents, how do you apply the modified categorical approach?
And I misspoke slightly. In Washington, at the end of footnote 6...
No, I'm asking about the record here. Are there any Shepherd documents in the record, yes or no?
Yes, if you, because Washington says in footnote 6...
No. Are there any documents in the record? Can you show me a document?
I can explain. Washington says once the defendant does not object to the description of his prior offense in the PSR, that becomes a factual basis on which the district court could rely.
So we're going to go 10 years on the fact that he didn't say something about the PSR.
His obligation, if he objected to the application of the modified categorical approach, his lawyer had to file an objection, and that would have forced the court to discuss what basis it used to apply the ACCA enhancement here. His counsel, being fully aware of the issue of enumerated of burglary and the application of the crime of violence violent felony definition, and having requested the documents from California, as the court recognized.
Wait. Who requested the documents?
Ms. McMurray, Mr. Copeland's attorney, says, I've gotten the statutes and I'm trying to get the documents from California, but it takes a while.
Counsel, there were no documents in the record.
Because there was no objection. Had there been an objection?
They're either in the record or they're not.
But that's what Washington says, is if there's no objection, the court can rely
on... I'm just asking you as a fact, can you give me a cite to the record where I can find those documents?
The Shepherd documents, the PSR functions as the Shepherd document where there's no objection. That's what Washington says in footnote 6.
Well, the no objection, you still haven't answered the question.
The no objection part came at sentencing. And obviously they were not going to call up California on the day of sentencing and say, please send us the documents. So it's not because he didn't object that there were no Shepherd documents.
No, it's because they didn't object that the Shepherd documents were not admitted. I went up and talked to our AUSA and said, did you get these documents? And they said they pulled them, they looked at them, and from the basis in the PSR.
Is that in the record?
I don't know that it is.
With the AUSA?
No, and I'm not saying that that's the basis. But at the end of the day, these cases in 2008 were resolved when the parties looked at the record and go, yep, there's nothing there. That's a burglary of a building. It qualifies. And then there's no objection filed and no need to prove to the district court what the basis, what the Shepherd documents
were. There was no Johnson case then either, was there?
That's true.
Counsel, before you move on, can I just ask, do you think there should be any special weight placed on the district court's determination here? Because the district court did do the sentencing? I mean, that question came up, and you didn't give an answer to that. So I'm wondering, how do we take that into account? if at all?
Washington, I think, had the same situation and noted that the district court was the sentencing court, and it didn't specify what the weight given should be. But in a case like this, where the district court is reviewing its own record about what it did in 2008, if it can find support in that record for its conclusion, I think that's a conclusion that should be deferred to. But frankly, that's also the deference that should be given under a clear error standard.
So you think it's just the same as the clear error standard?
I think so.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That completes the arguments on this case. The case will be submitted, and counsel are excused.